This week on Our World, monkeys respond to music, just not the kind we listen to, disturbing news about mercury in fish, and a preview of the next generation of the world's best-selling computer operating system.
Windows 7 is, more than anything else, an attempt by Microsoft to make amends for some of the failures in Windows Vista.
Those stories, students do science on their school vacation, and more. I'm Art Chimes. Welcome to the 500th edition of VOA Science and Technology magazine, Our World. Can music change your emotional state? Many music lovers would say yes. And they'd agree that listening to Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings puts you in an entirely different emotional place than, say, Metallica. Responding to music is something that humans all over the world, in perhaps every culture, have done for thousands of years, maybe as long as there have been human beings. But what about non-humans? University of Wisconsin psychology professor Charles Snowden has just published the results of an experiment designed to find out.
David Tai, my collaborator, is a cellist in the National Symphony and also a composer. And he's also been thinking really hard about how does music have an emotional impact on us human beings, and has come up with some theoretical ideas about the tricks that composers can use to make music have an emotional effect on us.
It turns out that composers have, perhaps inadvertently, been adopting some of the ways we use pitch and tempo in speech, in addition to the words we use.
So if I'm talking to a baby, I'll say, "Aw, I'm sorry." And we soothe a child who's upset. We use long, slow notes that start at a high pitch and go down. But if I want to get a dog or a child active in doing something, I'd say, come on, let's go, let's go. And there's short, very short bursts of sound that start at a low pitch and go up to a high pitch.
Snowden oversees a research collection of copper-top tamarins, a monkey native to Colombia. And in the experiment, the monkeys got to listen to Samuel Barber and Metallica and some other music that, in humans, would prompt particular emotional responses.
With the calming music, we should see them get calmer, move less, maybe eat more. If we're playing arousing music, they should move much more. They should show anxious behaviors. What we found basically was that they showed none of those types of responses to the human-based music.
So classical music, heavy metal, does nothing for the tamarin monkeys. But what if a composer, like maybe Snowden's collaborator David Tai, wrote some music specifically designed to appeal to a simian listener? How would you approach that?
We recorded a lot of vocalizations from the monkeys, and the pitches are typically about 3 octaves higher than they are in humans, and their tempos are about twice as fast as human speech or music would be. So knowing that the monkeys had a different pitch range and a different tempo, David composed pieces that were based on their calming vocalizations and based on their threat or arousing vocalizations to basically cover those acoustic principles that he thought were important in inducing emotions.
So here, for example, is what an upset monkey sounds like. And here's David Tai's musical interpretation based on tamarin fear and threat sounds. In the experiment, researchers at Snowden's lab played the newly composed music for the monkeys and noted how they reacted. Sure enough, unlike when they listened to human music, the monkeys responded, acting agitated when listening to that threatening music, for example. Charles Snowden and David Tai report the results of the work in the journal Biology Letters. One thing not mentioned in the published paper, I wondered how the monkeys might react to non-Western music. Snowden said he didn't test that, but he speculates that the copper-top tamarins wouldn't have any more emotional reaction to Indian ragas or Javanese gamelan music than they did to the Western music they heard. A new study in the United States found widespread contamination of toxic mercury in fish from streams that appear to be pristine. As VOA's Steve Barragona reports, it's the latest indication of how widespread mercury pollution is.
Mercury is poisonous to the nervous system, and it's especially harmful to young children. Exposure to a form called methylmercury can damage children's memory, attention, language skills, and other mental abilities as they develop. In the new report, researchers from the U.S. Geological Survey, or USGS, studied nearly 300 freshwater streams across the United States from 1998 to 2005. They examined mercury levels in fish at the top of the food chain, the kind that fishermen prize, such as bass and trout. The study found that one quarter of them had mercury levels above what are considered safe. Geochemist Mark Brigham, one of the authors of the study, says some of the highest levels of contamination were in fish from relatively undisturbed streams that were surrounded by forests and wetlands.
And those environments are very conducive to converting inorganic mercury to methylmercury.
Brigham says bacteria are responsible for converting mercury to the form that travels up the food chain to fish and fish-eating creatures, including people. And those bacteria thrive in wetland and forest environments. But where is the mercury in these undisturbed environments coming from?
The only mercury that they're getting is from atmospheric deposition.
In other words, mercury falling from the sky. Brigham says it gets into the atmosphere from a variety of natural and industrial sources. The single largest man-made contributor to that pollution is burning coal for energy. That mercury may be coming from far outside the United States, according to Desiree Narbaez with the United Nations Environment Program.
The nature of mercury is that it transports globally. So any emission of mercury from one continent can affect the other continent. So if you say there are emissions from Asia, for example, it can affect North America. Or the other way around, from North America can also affect Africa.
That makes mercury pollution a global issue, she says. The U.S. is the number three mercury emitter, behind India and well behind China. Gina Solomon, with the Natural Resources Defense Council, says the U.S. needs to take the lead in reducing its mercury emissions before asking the same of developing countries.
But I think that there is a compelling need for health reasons for all the countries of the world to reduce their mercury pollution. And this certainly applies to Asia, where the power industry is a major source of global mercury pollution.
Asia is also a major fish consumer. Not a lot of good research has been done in this area, but the UN's Desiree Narbaez says spot checks have turned up some high levels of mercury in Asian fish. Study author Mark Brigham says mercury accumulates up the food chain, from algae to small fish to big predatory fish. So the biggest fish tend to have the most mercury. Smaller fish and those lower in the food chain tend to be safer, for example, catfish, shrimp, and pollock. Brigham notes that most of the fish his group sampled were safe to eat, and health experts recommend eating fish as part of a healthy diet, as long as it's not contaminated with too much mercury. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
And it's time again for our website of the week, when we showcase interesting and innovative online destinations. One of journalism's most important functions is to hold powerful institutions accountable. And one way the media does that is through investigative journalism, where reporters will spend weeks, maybe years, doing interviews, combing through archives, sifting through databases. It's hard work, sometimes tedious, often expensive, and occasionally dangerous. There must be a million websites featuring news, but at our website of the week, the focus is on investigative journalism.
ProPublica.org is a website for a nonprofit investigative journalism organization. We're really looking for stories with moral force, stories about people being exploited, people in power taking advantage of people who aren't in power. That's the kind of thing that we investigate.
Eric Umansky is a senior editor at ProPublica, one of more than 30 experienced journalists on the staff. Investigative journalism has traditionally been done by teams of reporters and researchers at newspapers or broadcasters. ProPublica is different. They're funded mostly by foundation grants, and the work they do is not just available on their own website. Anyone may republish it online or in print as long as it's properly credited.
Our mandate is for our stories to have impact. Well, you know, the way you have impact is not just by limiting it to your site, but by encouraging other people to run your stories too. So why wouldn't we want other people to run our stories?
In fact, ProPublica's first big splash was last year when a joint investigation they did with the American TV network CBS was featured on the top-rated news show 60 Minutes. The topic, incidentally, was VOA's sister broadcaster, the Arabic-language Al Hura television. At ProPublica.org, you can read their investigative stories on health and science, the economy, and business. National security stories focus on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, detainees in Guantanamo, and other topics. Eric Umansky says the independent ProPublica model makes sense at a time when American journalism, especially the newspaper business, is facing a tough economy and a very uncertain future. But he admits it may not necessarily be right in other countries.
Every place is going to be different, and I wouldn't want to say you should copy ProPublica because different locations and different countries have different needs. But I would say that, you know, we are one model, one way of doing this kind of work, of doing work that holds your government and other institutions accountable for the power that they have.
Investigate some of today's best investigative journalism at ProPublica.org, or get the link to this and more than 250 other websites of the week from our site, voanews.com/ourworld. It's Our World, the weekly science and technology magazine from VOA News. I'm Art Chimes in Washington. This week, Apple Computer began shipping the latest version of its operating system called Snow Leopard. But for the vast majority of the world's personal computers, the big upgrade event comes next month when Microsoft begins shipping the newest version of its operating system, Windows 7. I spoke with Robert Strohmeyer, senior editor at PC World magazine, about the latest iteration of the Windows franchise, and my first question was, do we even need a new version of Windows?
The biggest reason we need a new version of Windows is that the current version, Windows Vista, has made a lot of people very unhappy. So Windows 7 is, more than anything else, an attempt by Microsoft to make amends for some of the failures in Windows Vista.
Well, for ordinary users who are using XP now or Vista, what's the biggest difference that they're going to see out of the box?
If you're running Windows XP now, you're going to see a tremendous number of differences because, of course, many of the graphical effects of Windows Vista are now included in Windows 7 as well. However, you get those graphics improvements without the system resource slowdowns that had come with them previously. And it has a feature called Jump Lists that makes it easier to navigate through the menus in a contextual way so that what you're looking for is grouped together with things that you would automatically associate with them.
So you've been playing with this. What is the best thing about Windows? Is there a compelling reason to upgrade if you already are using a Windows machine and you're happy with it?
That depends a great deal on what you want to do. For instance, if you're an avid gamer, it's a double-edged sword. Windows XP is a very stable operating system for people who like to play PC video games. However, it doesn't come with the DirectX 10 graphics support of some of the highest-end games, such as Crysis. That said, if you are running an older PC, if you've got a PC that's 2 or maybe 3 years old, ultimately, you're going to get better performance on the same resources with Windows XP than with Windows 7.
Yeah. One of the most popular computer segments these days, of course, is the netbook, these small, modestly powered laptops. Also, a lot of our listeners might have older machines. Is Windows 7 right for those sorts of platforms?
Windows 7 is actually great for those platforms because it runs so much better than Vista did. And actually, the performance on netbooks is fairly comparable to that of Windows XP, which also does quite well on the netbook platform. One issue that is sort of gumming up the works here is that Microsoft has come out with a new policy to restrict licensing of Windows 7 to machines that have a 10-inch screen or larger, which means some of these small netbooks won't be able to run the full version of Windows 7. They'll only be able to use Windows 7 Starter Edition.
There are, in fact, a lot of different editions, different flavors of Windows 7 coming out. Is consumer choice here a good thing, or is it just too much?
I think consumer choice is always a good thing. The question is that consumer choice legitimate, or is Microsoft simply attempting to get extra money for features that they choose to charge a premium for. Meanwhile, pretty much all of those features are available by default in a single version, for instance, on the Mac, and pretty much all of those features come in just about any significant Linux distribution, such as Ubuntu.
Yeah. So you've been working with Windows 7. What's the most annoying thing? What do you wish that they had done differently or included that they didn't?
Well, the biggest problem is you can't easily make the upgrade from Windows XP to Windows 7. If you want to go from Windows XP to Windows 7, you need to back up all your data, do a brand new clean installation, and then reinstall everything from your backup, which is far from ideal.
How important is it to Microsoft that they get this version of Windows right?
I would say it's absolutely critical. Microsoft has really suffered a PR disaster with Windows Vista, which was a functional operating system that a lot of people liked, but the bad press and the user outrage were significant enough to really stain it. And one thing we saw happen during that period is a massive amount of growth on competing platforms such as Apple's Mac OS X. And while Windows is still by far the dominant operating system, a blunder with Windows 7 will be disastrous for them.
One other notable change we should mention, a security feature introduced in Vista called User Account Control, which many users found particularly annoying, is still there, but PC World's Robert Strohmeyer says it's significantly less irritating in the new version. So we have two new operating systems facing off. How do they compare? Well, the folks at ComputerWorld.com pit the Windows and Mac upgrades against each other and call it basically a tie. Preston Growler writes that the Mac upgrade, Snow Leopard, is more beautiful and elegant as well as simpler to use, but that Windows is catching up. But Growler notes that Windows 7 is more tweakable for users who want the computing experience on their own terms, and Windows remains the corporate standard for networks running hundreds of computers. And finally today, this is the time of year when American kids go back to school. The time-honored question when classes resume is, what did you do on your summer vacation? Well, for several dozen lucky students, they'll be able to describe their 8 intensive weeks at a century-old facility called the Mount Desert Island Biological Laboratory. The BioLab, as it's known, has long been recognized for its cutting-edge marine and biomedical research and for its award-winning educational programs. VOA's Julie Tabo spoke with some of this year's students as they wrapped up their projects.
22-year-old Kavita Balkaran says her summer at the Mount Desert Island Biological Laboratory was amazing.
I do research back home at UVI, but here it's like all day round. It's not stressful. It's an informal setting and it's great to just lay back, and I love that about it.
Balkaran, a student at the University of the Virgin Islands, spent 8 weeks with a BioLab mentor, studying the connection between a 19-hectare mussel aquaculture operation and an underwater sea plant called eelgrass in the nearby bay. Patricia Hand directs the BioLab's education programs. She says the lab provides training for researchers at all levels, from high school students through established scientists, and they come from all around the world.
We're very fortunate in that we have a broad community that we serve, not only students here in Maine, but also national and international students. Students from Germany, Sri Lanka, Croatia, Italy have all joined us here, as well as some of the African nations as well.
Now wait 2 hours and see
Wait 2 hours and see what happens.
Veronica Hernandez is a student at the University of Puerto Rico. She came to the BioLab to work on fish physiology.
The experience was really good. It's the first time that I worked with animal physiology. So it was interesting working with organisms that you can see changes in their regulation patterns and how they react to environmental changes.
Hernandez says what made the program so valuable for her was the one-on-one instruction and interaction.
He's an excellent mentor. He's a great teacher. He makes you think outside the box. So it was very nice working with J.B. Claiborne.
James Claiborne is a biology professor at Georgia Southern University and a summer scientist at the BioLab. He says his experience as a graduate student at the lab 30 summers ago inspired him to become a mentor himself.
Veronica's been great. She was able to generate data in the problem that we gave her, and she was able to come up with results that no one's ever found before.
Being the first to discover something, says Claiborne, is always an exciting moment for the students.
The results they're obtaining are maybe most often the case are the first time anyone in human history has ever seen the thing that they're looking at on a gel or on their scan or whatever. They may be the first human to have ever seen those results. So that always gets them excited and gets me excited every time.
And the results of that excitement are impressive. Almost 90% of the students who have been through the BioLab training program have gone on to pursue a career in science. Kavita Balkran says her experience working on eelgrass restoration at the BioLab will help her start her own outreach program at home in the Virgin Islands.
Oh, I mean, seagrass is a turtle grass. So what I've learned here, I can take back home and instead of eelgrass, use it to help turtle grass.
Balkran says her summer at the BioLab has also inspired her to continue her education with a focus on marine mammals. She plans to study for a master's degree and eventually earn a PhD. From Bar Harbor, Maine, I'm Julie Tabo, VOA News.
And that is our show for this week. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our email address is ourworld@voanews.com or use the postal address, Our World, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Our program number 500 was edited by Faith Lapidus. Bob Doty is the technical director. And this is Art Chimes, inviting you to join us online at voanews.com/ourworld or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science and technology in Our World.